Hello, friends. This is Deepa Iyer welcoming you to the November edition of Solidarity Is This. This is a monthly podcast that looks at solidarity practices in America. And I'm really excited that we're able to bring guests from all around the country to talk to us about what it means to build solidarity at a time when our racial landscape is rapidly shifting and at a time when communities of color are experiencing threats both in the public sphere and also from policies coming from government. If you've heard past podcasts, you know that we've had guests join us to discuss campaigns in which solidarity is a central organizing value. We've heard about the campaign to fight off the Muslim ban. We've heard about efforts to preserve immigration benefits for undocumented young people. And we've heard about the campaigns to save temporary protected status for those who cannot return to their countries of origin. But how do we practice solidarity when we aren't in a crisis moment? How do we build on a daily basis when we don't have a campaign to save our rights that are being taken away, for example? What happens when we take the time to build solidarity person by person, neighborhood by neighborhood, community by community? That is what we'll be talking about today in this podcast called Our Community is Our Campaign. That's the motto of a grassroots organization called Freedom Inc., which is based in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm so excited that we have the co-directors of Freedom Inc. with us on our podcast, Kajwa Vaj and M. Adams. Kajwa and M., welcome to Solidarity Is This.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I know that we met last summer and had a little bit of time to get to know each other, and I remember being so inspired by Freedom Inc.'s work because it's a type of cross-racial, cross-community work and community building that we don't actually hear much about around the country, even though it is happening. And I also remember feeling like I had stepped into a family when I met the young folks who make up the soul of your organization. So I'm hoping that we can convey a little bit of that to our audience through this podcast today. So I want to start out actually by asking a little bit about Freedom Inc. itself. Where exactly do you all organize and who are the communities that you organize? Kajwa, why don't we start with you?
Freedom Inc. started about 16 years ago, almost 17 years ago. And it started with lone youth and young people in Madison, Wisconsin. And it really was just me trying to provide a space for Southeast Asian and Hmong girls to come and have conversations and really look at what was happening in their lives. And then eventually over the years, we became a nonprofit. And as we were doing work within our own communities, and we were doing girl-specific work in our own communities, we noticed that there were also Black girls in the communities that we were serving that also needed and wanted space for themselves. And so that started our work in the Black community. We created space and opportunities for them to start their own groups, and eventually Freedom Inc. evolved to becoming a Black and Hmong organization. And then more recently, we've added our Cambodian component to our work, and we serve and provide services and advocacy and organize around racial justice and gender justice issues within Madison, predominantly with folks who identify as being queer, femme, poor, working class in Madison, Wisconsin, and in the surrounding areas.
And I think I definitely want to delve into a little bit more about the Southeast Asian community and how the community got there. But I want to bring Em in and also hear Em about how the organization has evolved in the way that it includes Southeast Asian communities, but also Black communities. Can you talk a little bit about that evolution process?
I came into the organization close to 10 years ago. At the moment, it was part of this garage where young Black girls in particular were wanting to do something similar to what the Hmong girls are doing, which is having a space where they can talk about themselves, personal goals, as well as like how these big things, like systems and institutions, were impacting them in their lives. And so I came into the organization at that time, and I really helped to think through, you know, what did it mean for Black folks to be building Black power in a majority white city? Mm-hmm. And also to think through, what does it mean to actually have Black and Southeast Asian camaraderie, to have family, to have movement together, as well as thinking to those questions, but also because we were also gender specific at the time, thinking about how do we expand that to also be queer and trans-centered. So what did it also mean to have culturally specific, gender specific, generation specific marches for freedom for queer and trans folks.
I remember, Kajwa, that you saying once that the neighborhoods, you know, historically in the Madison area where you all organize are mixed in terms of race. And you also have talked a bit about in the past that I've heard you talk about the refugees who were placed into Madison. And I was wondering if you could trace a little bit of that history for us in terms of the neighborhoods you work in and what the demographics have looked like and the history has looked like.
In the late 1970s to the early 80s, there was an influx right after the American war in Southeast Asia. There was an influx of Southeast Asian refugees, mainly Cambodian, Laotian, and folks coming from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And this influx of refugees, the resettlement programs in the United States basically placed and resettled all of us into really poor, low-income communities. And basically, they didn't set us up with any infrastructures to survive. And so we were dropped in these neighborhoods pretty much overnight and left to, like, fend for ourselves. And so what you see are today a lot of Southeast Asian families still living side by side, on top of each other, amongst Black and brown folks in the U.S. And so the history of Southeast Asian resettlement has made it so that growing up, I grew up around a lot of Black folks, but because of the cultural differences, we never really talked to each other. We knew we lived in the same communities, but we didn't have that type of relationship. And so when Freedom Inc. started to do work and actually go into our own communities, that's why it was such a natural fit. Like, oh, there are Black folks here. Well, there's always been Black folks in our communities because we actually came into their communities. And so I think that when Freedom Inc., when we started doing that work, it was a kind of a natural request from the Black girls because they were Black programming or programming within their community centers to provide services to the whole community, but there was nothing specifically for Black girls. And so when they had that request, we knew as Southeast Asian women and girls and queer folks that we weren't the right ones to lead Black girls, but we also knew that we could provide a space and we knew how to provide a culturally specific space. And so that's what we did.
Yeah. And I wanted to just make sure that folks heard what you said in the beginning when you were tracing that history, that you called it the American War. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that reframe.
The U.S. looks at that war. Mm-hmm. It's called the Vietnam War. But for those of us who are impacted by America's involvement in Southeast Asia, we call it the American War in Southeast Asia. And so that's how we reframed it. Because it is, in fact, their involvement in our countries that led us to come here. And it wasn't just the Vietnam, but it was a Vietnamese war.
Just so folks know, Kajwa is talking about Southeast Asian folks, Hmong, Laotian, Cambodian, and others who were displaced and brought here and then, quote, resettled in different parts of this country and not provided, as Kajwa mentioned, with the sustenance and the types of benefits that they needed to eke out a living. So I just want to make sure that folks are aware of some of that history as well. So Em, I wanted to turn to you because I know that both you and Kajwa talked about the importance of having spaces that were separate in a way that catered to the needs of Black girls as well as Hmong and other Southeast Asian communities. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the places where that work has intersected, where both communities have come together. Are there specific campaigns or other initiatives where there's been an ability to kind of build that sort of solidarity between the communities that you all organize with?
We've been able to have success in our work, which we talk about and see as Black and Southeast Asian liberation work, which I think sometimes people call it multiracial organizing. You know, we stay away from framing it that way because it's really about communities having their own independent struggles and building those movements alongside of one another. Because we understand our work that way, we have been able to build spaces where each community can talk about the unique ways that they're impacted by systems and issues, can talk about what it looks like in culture, what it looks like for how they experience particular institutions. Mm-hmm. And once people are able to explore that within their own experience, their own community's experience, or an identity group experience, then we can build a shared analysis.
But to give an example of this girls group and then to talk about some of the work that they did together, when we were starting the girls group, we said, okay, put them all together, the black girls and the mom girls, and it was a huge disaster.
Mm.
And some of it was for what I think people would anticipate to be like cultural communication stuff. There was certainly some of that, right? Like there was different languages spoken. There were some groups preferred directness, some groups preferred other methods of communication, et cetera. So there was certainly some of that. But it wasn't just that. It was about the actual thing that we were discussing. People experienced them in such a different material way that it was difficult for them to talk about the same. So, for example, though both groups, Hmong girls, black girls, experienced patriarchal violence or patriarchy within their community, the Hmong girls talked about it and how it showed up in polygamy, how it showed up in their fathers having multiple wives, or abusive international marriages where men would go back to Southeast Asia and basically exploit like younger women. And the black girls didn't have a reference point for that. And in fact, they were like, no way, that's unheard of to us, and we would never, right? Like, this is sort of their response to it. And the black girls would be talking about how many of them growing up in single mom households, like some of them having different fathers in the same household, in the ways that men could not be there, be in and out, and things like that. And the Hmong girls were like, absolutely not. We would never allow that. You have to be married. It should be, you know, their cultural standard was that there should be one father. You know, so there was just people experienced the same root issue, patriarchy, but the experience around it was so vastly different that we couldn't sensibly have a conversation about it at that point. And so we knew that if we were going to seriously talk about patriarchy, that instead of trying to convince the other group, the legitimacy of the other group's struggle, that we first had to go into people's own experiences and their own struggles. And so we did that. And when we were able to do that and spend more time doing that, then we could build a shared analysis. So then we could say to the black girls, okay, so this thing that you're talking about is patriarchy. And patriarchy doesn't just happen to you. It happens across racial cultural groups. Right? So, and this is how it looks over here. The same thing for the Hmong girls. We were able to have that conversation. And then when we were able to do that, they began to be able to see sisterhood amongst each other. Before, they were looking to be the same, but they no longer looked the same. They were no longer looking to have the same story, right? But what they recognized was there was a shared struggle. And from that point, these two groups became the leading groups for all of our youth organizing campaigns. It was black girls, it was Hmong girls, and then later it was queer black youth, queer Southeast Asian youth, who worked together on a variety of issues. In 2010, these were the same young girls who, when the Wisconsin uprising was happening, where there were hundreds of thousands of mainly white professional workers who were occupying the Capitol, it was these young black and young Southeast Asian girls who were in the center of the Capitol saying, you know, we're also going to fight for rape to be considered rape in the law. We're also going to fight for food stamps. We're going to fight for badger care and health care. We're going to fight for better education. So they were the vanguard of really challenging that movement to not just be what it was turning into, just to be like work really around white middle-class professionals, but also to be based on those most impacted.
I think one of the things that struck me when you were speaking was really this importance of when we say we do cross-racial, multiracial solidarity work, that it's really important not to flatten people's experiences and to assume that there is a shared analysis or a shared struggle from the start. So the way that you talked about the sequential approach of first really having those independent conversations about patriarchy was the example you gave, but really about, you know, what does liberation look like for Hmong girls? What does it look like for black folks? What does it look like for anyone else, right, who's kind of in these struggles? That is really important to do that independently at some level before people are kind of brought into campaigns, assuming that there is going to be a shared language or a shared analysis. So I thought that that was extremely helpful in terms of understanding the way in which you do this work rather than just, oh, well, it sounds great, right? But the way in which you do it is just so important. The process is so important. So thank you for laying some of that out. Kajwa, yes, would love to hear a little bit about whether you think that that's the approach that, you know, the independent conversations within groups about what liberation looks like and then kind of bringing folks together. How has that worked, especially as you all have been working on issues related to housing? I know that you all work in low-income neighborhoods. Tell us a little bit about how issues around class inequity, housing, displacement have worked out using that approach.
When people think about building solidarity and building a racial justice movement, I think that people often forget that outside of race, there's all these other components people have to take into consideration. And I think that gender is one of those that people often don't take into consideration. And then also this intergenerational movement, right? And so I think that one of the things that we've been able to do also really well is we've been working with elders, and we've been working not just around housing justice or environmental justice issues or queer justice issues, but we've been really doing a lot of our work through the gender justice lens and attacking and really trying to figure out how to end interpersonal violence or gender-based violence within communities. And so one of the things that I think is important about our work is, and to answer that question, is around providing services and advocacy for domestic violence and sexual assault. And so I think, like what Em was talking about, like we've realized and understand that patriarchy impacts and misogyny impacts our community. Definitely it impacts all of our communities, but how does it manifest differently, and what does it look like in each of these communities? Mm-hmm. And so to give you an example, we know that we need to end patriarchy and we need to call out misogyny. But in the Khmer community, it looks very different than it would in the Black community. And so some of the programs that we provide, like, really look at those differences through the lens of, yes, we have a shared foundation of what we're trying to end, but because it manifests itself and it looks so different, like, our programs also have to respond to that. And so to give you an example, for our Black elders or Black folks that we're working with that are surviving violence, mm-hmm. like therapy or Black-specific therapists may be the answer. But for our Khmer folks, it's the Buddhist temple. Mm-hmm. And that's where they get all of their healing, and that's where we gather and they like get to regroup. And then for the Hmong folks, there's also a treatment center in town that we send folks to, or it's just that many of them are shamans, or they still mm-hmm. practice animism. And so how do we like push for that type of healing? And so I think that, you know, it's like throughout all of our programs, we're really specific in how we craft the programs to fit the needs of each of these communities. But at the same time, understanding, like what Em was saying, is that we're actually here for shared liberation. And what does that look like? And one of the things that we're really keen on is that we get free in our own communities, and then we come together and figure out what that looks like in mainstream communities.
So shared liberation and co-liberation is the goal, but it's really important to figure out what that means and looks like in our own communities. I want to go back to that and ask, actually, if both of you could share a little bit about when the campaigns have included, and I think, Em, you were starting to talk about that, so maybe I'll turn to you first. When both communities come together, how powerful is that? And what are some of the observations that you've made as co-directors when you've seen Black and Hmong or other Southeast Asian communities come together? Are there some examples of those sorts of campaigns or initiatives? And what has that meant to you? We'll start with you, Em.
Before I address the specific campaigns, I also want to say in the everyday work of our organization, that's also what we're doing. So in the things that are not as outward-facing or as visible, when we're talking about some of like the life-saving domestic violence and sexual assault services that we're providing, like folks are co-advocating, right? So we have Khmer folks showing up for Black folks, and Black folks showing up for Hmong folks, et cetera. And so in our everyday practice, we're really walking out our values. We're really living out our values. So I want to uplift that work. But some examples of campaign work that has been really critical. In the last few years, we've had some really intense direct action campaigns targeted at police violence, mm-hmm. so demanding community control over the police. We've also had some campaigns targeted around stopping mass incarceration, which is really around getting Black people out of the jail and stopping the county from building a new jail. This was at a moment, like many other places around the country, where there's lots of urban rebellions led by Black people in the streets, and we certainly were doing that here in Madison. Mm-hmm. And so as we were doing that work, our Southeast Asian folks are right in the streets with us doing that work. And I think that's important to name because what you probably have observed nationally is while that was happening in other communities with Black folks, there were some Asian folks who were like, oh, we better show up. And they created Asians for Black Lives,
right,
which I think was an important intervention. I think it's important. So this is no diss to him. I mention that to say that you are actually Black liberation and Southeast Asian liberation. You don't need an Asian for Black Lives because we're already in it together doing the work. And so that was an example of incredible work we did together. So what we did do together is we stopped the building of a $160 million jail right here in Bend County. What we did do is force the city to have a conversation or shift narratives around the function of policing. What we did do was challenge police power in every single sector that we could challenge it. And then what we did do is develop young leaders, elder leaders, women, queer, trans, Black, Khmer, and Hmong leaders in that process. And so we were able to have a whole bunch of wins. We were able to win on a lot of different fronts and a lot of different sectors. And it's pretty clear to me that if we were not already doing that day-in, day-out work that I mentioned at the beginning, which you're pointing at, like the thing that's not so visible, the thing that people don't write the headlines about, if you don't do that, then this other work is impossible.
It doesn't happen.
Exactly. And so we've been able to not only win here locally, we've also been able to help other people around the country think through these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we went to Ferguson and Kaja to speak about this, where like our Southeast Asian folks are having conversation with Asian store owners where the urban rebellions were happening and helping them to be in alignment with what was happening, even if it cost their business an impact, et cetera. But she can speak more to that.
I think that point around the co-advocating on a daily basis and the relationship building, as you're right, that's key, right?
Yes.
And so without that, yeah, people can kind of show up for each other in campaigns, but it doesn't go deep unless you have those relationships built. And I'm also curious, Kaja, about, you know, what you think about Em's really insightful comment that I'm going to be thinking about a lot, which is, well, why do we need an Asians for Black Lives, right? So is that the sort of solidarity work that we need to be doing? Or is it to do the type of work that you all are doing with Freedom Inc., where people are in it together? And so there doesn't need to be necessarily another sort of solidarity type of frame. So I'm curious to see also what you think of that and your work in Ferguson as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if there were more organizations and people throughout the U.S. doing exactly what we're doing, which is being with each other every day, then there wouldn't need to be an Asian for Black Lives. But because a lot of Asian folks don't live next door to or aren't involved in with Black and brown folks every day, which is unfortunate. But I hear a lot of like API students or folks throughout the U.S. who are saying, I just don't have that much daily connection with Black folks or brown folks. And so I think that in those cases, there may be a need for Asians for Black Lives. You know? So I think that there's like different components of how Asian folks can participate. And so I don't know if being in solidarity with each other every day and cohabitating every day is something that works for those who have been in the U.S. longer and don't have the context, the historical context of Southeast Asians or even some South Asian folks, right?
You know, both of you work with and are thought leaders in broader movements in your own communities. And I'm curious to know, you know, Kaja, first with you, and also picking up that thread that Em talked about the work that happened in Ferguson. I know you're connected to CFIN, the Southeast Asian Freedom Network. You're connected to groups like National Capacity and others. I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about how the work that you do at Freedom Inc. informs the way that you influence and guide some of these more national initiatives that are focused on AAPI communities.
You know, within Southeast Asian Freedom Network, building Black and Southeast Asian solidarity is one of our key components to being part of CFIN. And so I think that though I would love to take credit for how Freedom Inc. works and is building Black and Southeast Asian solidarity, I have to say that Mekong and PRISM and a lot of these other organizations that are central to Southeast Asian Freedom Network leadership, they also have been doing this work, similar work, in their own communities throughout the U.S., and so I feel like it's something that those of us who have been core to CFEN has practiced over the last 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's been, I think, really refreshing, and they, in fact, have helped inform how I move in my work. And so I feel like that organization I probably have the most impact in.
And did you have anything you wanted to add about what happened in Ferguson and bringing folks from Freedom Inc. there, Southeast Asian folks there?
I think that that was like the beginning of us practicing what it looked like, because we had tried to build with each other on a daily basis.
Right.
So we didn't know any other way but to show up for each other. And so if we were shutting down a street or we were trying to get them to stop building a jail, and we would all just go. So we didn't even see it as solidarity work or as allyship. We just saw it like, this is bad for our community, let's go. I think when Ferguson happened, like, we went there and we're like, oh, like, Asian folks or other folks have to learn how to show up. So, like, it was natural for Zhong and I, two Hmong folks, to say, hey, there's a rebellion happening. They just shot and killed a Black person, and our Black folks want to go, and this might be traumatizing. Let me drive you.
Mm-hmm.
The second time we went, it was the Black Lives Matter gathering. Mm-hmm. We were like, okay, you want to sit here and build leadership with and have conversations with your people? Zhong and I said, let's go and get you food. What do you need? Do you need us to pick you up? So it was really just like showing up in a very human, humanistic way of like, okay, let me support you where I can. And then that's when I think the conversation of like, how do we show up and how do we be good allies? And so it was a really, like, it was easy for us to help, like, like the Korean American Center in Chicago. And they said, we're kind of unsure how to be in the space. You know, it was easy for us to just like be like, oh, you know what? It's easy. Just kind of show up and they put their bodies on the line, you put your bodies on the line. And so I think that that was the first time we were like, okay, so people actually don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And people actually don't know if they're stepping on each other's toes or, you know, how do I show up and what do I do? And then the other thing that I remember about Ferguson was we had a connection with somebody in St. Louis or in Ferguson. And she's like, actually, I know the store owners on that block where Mike Brown was killed. So we went there and we actually sat down, and it was a Chinese restaurant, and it was some South Asian lawyer.
Yeah.
And we all sat there and we said, this is what you guys should do. Like, why aren't you giving out free food? Like, why aren't you closing down your doors and say, we're standing in solidarity? Like, what's happening here? And so I think that was a really important conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And Em was there, and we just kind of, like, was in the moment. And we were able to, like, really push the past. Like, you know, it's not enough to come up with a statement. Like, I don't understand why you're not cooking for the people who are protesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why you're not closing your doors and saying, like, we stand in solidarity with my firm. Like, why are you still in business, right? And so I think that that was a really good moment for us.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those stoners did show up, you know. It seemed like the Muslim, Arab, South Asian store owners. And so that was really important to see. And I just want to lift up, and then I'll turn to you, Em, for the last word on a question around the broader movement. I want to lift up CFIN again. And there was a really powerful letter that CFIN released in December of 2014. It was an open letter to the Southeast Asian community on Black solidarity. And you can find that online. We'll put it up on our solidarity syllabus at www.solidarityis.org. But it's a really powerful statement from the heart and clear and direct about struggle and solidarity and what that can look like really what it looks like, right? Rather than just kind of the words. So I urge everyone to read that. So Em, I wanted to turn to you for kind of the last word. You too have been very involved and influential in broader movements for racial justice and solidarity work. I know that you're involved with the Movement for Black Lives in particular and other efforts, and wanted to hear how the work that you're doing at Freedom Inc. has been influencing the broader national struggle.
We've shared a lot of successes, but it's also been pain. What we know is that not everybody stays, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody within the Southeast Asian community stayed with us when the decision was made intentionally 10 years ago, and not everybody in the Black community stayed with us when the intentional decision was made. It doesn't matter if only the leadership did that.
And
I think it's true not only of Kazu and I, for example, and not just the staff here, but also our members. And also our members' families and our members' family friends and the neighborhoods, et cetera. Right? So we're always doing that intense education. We're also doing that intense political leadership, political analysis building, but that it's really about communities and not just the selected few leaders, quote unquote, who have an analysis, right? And what we do know in the process is that that work can actually be very difficult. And so things that we've had to struggle around a lot of different things. We've had to struggle to figure out communication stuff. We've had to struggle around political ideology. One of the things that we're going to be talking about, and just briefly, we were talking even more about this yesterday, is, for example, how our movements, Black movements, and how Southeast Asian folks, communities, movements, have related to socialism and communism, or have not, right? For many of us, for Black folks here, African liberation movements around the globe, it has been life-saving. Those are our heroes. And for our Southeast Asian people, it's been that leadership that has killed many of their folks, that have been responsible for massive genocide, that has been responsible for war and death of so many. So even things like that, like how we see ourselves, how we talk about economic justice, what words resonate with us, like even things like that are a struggle, right? And so when people hear about the success, when they see our work, they see the victory, they see the thing that we built, they didn't necessarily see the process of the building, right? But to say that this is about a commitment to struggle, and so we are still trying to figure things out. We are still not always getting it right. We are still bumping our heads in places. But what we are is committed to one another. We're committed to figuring out our liberation alongside one another.
And as you mentioned, there's no dearth of moments, right, where we have to figure out how to stand up for each other. Right now, we're seeing, you know, Cambodians being deported, rounded up and deported around the country. We're seeing the temporary protected status for countries like Haiti and Sudan and others in jeopardy. We're seeing, obviously, the banned, quote, banned countries that include countries like Somalia, Yemen, and many others. And so there are opportunities for us to come together and build that shared analysis. But I think it really goes back to some of the points that you both were saying around how do we talk about it in our own communities and how do we co-advocate on that daily basis and not just on those big visible moments and how do we really commit ourselves to the struggle. I feel like you've given us, you know, food for thought and also some grounding principles in the ways that you all are organizing in Madison and then, of course, extending that to the national community. So I just want to thank both of you from the bottom of my heart because I know how busy you both are and to get you both in a room and able to talk on this podcast. I know that a lot of scheduling took place for you both to be able to do that. And I just want to really thank you from the bottom of my heart for the work that you do, for the way that you inspire me, each of you, and for being with us today on Solidarity Is This.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
I'm so grateful to M. Adams and Kajwa Vaj for joining us here and providing us with information about Freedom Inc. And for those of you who want to learn more about the organization and support it, here's their website. It's www.freedom-inc.org. We'll be adding links to Freedom Inc., some of the other organizations we mentioned on the podcast, as well as some reading material in the Solidarity syllabus that will accompany this podcast. You can find it at www.solidarityis.org. You'll also find on that website some information around case studies related to solidarity, organizing principles, and other information as well. I want to thank you all again for listening, and a special shout out to those of you who've been tweeting and subscribing and downloading the podcast. Please keep doing that. I really appreciate it. And I want to end our podcast with a quote from James Baldwin, who said, "The world is before you, and you need not take it or leave it as it was when you came in." I think those are meaningful words, especially for those of us who often feel that these times are hopeless and draining and a struggle. But they're words to live by, and I hope that you'll find inspiration from them as I do. Thank you again for joining, and I'll catch you next time on Solidarity Is This.